Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
Culture.
Competition.
Architecture.
The dirt.
Drinking.
Eating.
Reading.
Thinking.
God, I love the dirt.
Let's not waste any more time.
Let's go straight to the pod.
Thank you all for being here.
We greatly appreciate the support.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
You can make a golf course more fun and more interesting for the average golfer, and more thought-provoking and more challenging for the better player at the same time. But the idea is that you basically have to get the green right three different times. You've got to get it right in the subgrade, you've got to get it right in the gravel layer, and you've got to get it right at the final layer.
It's like playing telephone, kind of.
It is.
Hello, friends of the Tie Podcast. Today we are joined by golf architect Jay Blasi to learn more about one of his 2023 projects, a redesign at Lakeside Country Club in Houston, Texas. Outside of Mudball Monday, it's quite a rare occasion to see both Henry and myself on the same interview, but because this was a Tie offsite, really a Tie onsite visit, we each took a turn asking Jay questions about his work there and about the club. Part one will be focused on the playability of the golf course and will be led by Henry, along with dirt. We would absolutely never even think about depriving you guys of the dirt. Part two, Jay and I get into the other kind of dirt, talking about construction and the big ticket items that will be difficult to pick out on opening day. Credit to the entire team at Lakeside. We hope you guys enjoy these conversations, and we look forward to bringing you more content on this project as time passes. As always, thank you for listening to the Tie Podcast.
Yeah, this will be fun. It was great to get out to Lakeside a couple weeks ago, and both myself and Walker got the chance to see you in action in Houston. And now we're here to talk about it a little bit, so it'll be fun. But before we do that, before we talk about golf, we got to talk about dirt. So Jay, what have you been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking lately?
Well, I'm battling a little bit of a cold, so my drinking is limited to hot water with lemon. And then for whatever reason, since I was a little kid, whenever I'm under the weather, I drink orange juice and 7-Up together, which I didn't really know why I drank that until I watched the Last Dance documentary with Michael Jordan. And apparently that was like his go-to drink. So I'm sure as a little kid, I just wanted to be like Mike, and orange juice and 7-Up. So here we go. That's what I've been drinking. In terms of the eating, I was lucky enough a couple weeks ago to take a fun golf trip with my dad and brother. We went out to Detroit and played Franklin Hills and Oakland Hills, and then went down to Inverness. And as part of that, we did a little pizza tour. So we did some Detroit-style pizza, and there's a great place in town called Buddy's, which was recommended by different folks, and did not disappoint for kind of true Detroit pizza. There was another spot in town called Freddy the Pizza Man, which was more kind of New York-style thin. Excellent. And then we drove back to Wisconsin, where I grew up and my dad and brother live. And so we swung by my dad's old stomping grounds on the south side of Chicago and swung by Vito and Nick's for some kind of tavern style pizza. And then back in Madison, my favorite spot is the Greenbush Bar, which is in the basement of the Italian Workman's Club. And you can get some awesome kind of thin crust with an olive oil base down there that's excellent. So that's been the eating side of things lately.
That's a strong effort. I think Freddy the Pizza Man, if I'm not mistaken, they have like a big Instagram presence, don't they? That's popping up in my feed all the time, which probably says some things about me. But
I learned about it through the Barstool rating, which I'm not a huge Barstool following, but I do follow pizza ratings. So, and that one, you know, we kind of drove out of our way to get there, and it was worth it. It was good.
So, good stuff.
In terms of the reading, I'm just diving in, just starting Alan Shipnick's new book on live golf. And so literally just, 10 or 15 pages in, but excited to see where that goes. So far, it's got me turning the pages. So that's good. And then thinking, I just came back from the National Links Trust Symposium on Municipal Golf, which is a really great get together to talk about all angles of municipal golf, whether it's the design, maintenance, community outreach, fundraising, all those different things. And so there's so many great efforts going on around the country at different individual projects, different groups, whether it's First Tee or Evan Scholar or National Links Trust, all these different groups. And I've been thinking a lot about how can we kind of combine all those efforts to really, when you think about golf for the next 50 or 100 years, bringing people to the game. For 20 plus years, we've talked about growing the game, but that really hasn't happened. And it seems like there are ways that we could get there. We have so many great smaller efforts taking place that if there was a way to kind of synergize those things and get people working together across the whole country, that maybe there could be some kind of national programs that would make golf easier for people who don't typically play today to get exposed to it, kind of lower the barriers of entry, whether it's cost of equipment, cost to go to a facility, time it takes at a facility, just how hard it is to start out, those types of things. What we could do kind of nationally to combine all those things for the long-term health of the sport. So that's the thought process these days.
Awesome. That was bucket A dirt. That was really high quality stuff. Before we jump straight into Lakeside, I do want to ask, when we were together a couple weekends ago, you made a comment about when you were young that all you really wanted to do was design golf courses. Walk me through in as much length as you desire what that looked like. What was your inspiration as a young kid for getting into the game just at a high level? And then, what really grasped you within golf course architecture that made you say when you were young that that's what you wanted to do as a profession?
So my dad fell in love with golf. He was a caddy at Beverly Country Club on the south side of Chicago, and that's where he kind of fell in love with golf. So much so that when he and my mom met and they had their first house, he built a putting green in the backyard. So when I was born, a couple years later, he brought clubs to the hospital. When I was born, come home, there's a putting green in the backyard. So I've literally been crawling on a golf green my whole life and playing golf at the age of two in the backyard. In the backyard, we made our own little scorecard and made a little 18-hole course of where to go. Mind you, this backyard had shots up to about 18 yards, so not a big backyard. But there was still a scorecard and all that kind of stuff. And so we'd go out to dinner and I'd flip the placemat over and draw golf holes and crayon. We'd take family road trips in the car, and I'd just sit there for hours with my face planted against the window, looking out at the rolling fields, envisioning par fours and par fives. So it just was something that kind of got in my blood real early. It was kind of all I wanted to do or all I thought about. And I didn't really know any of the stuff that mattered. I didn't know the difference between an oak or a maple. I didn't know drainage or grading or any of those kinds of things. I did know golf. I'd been exposed to golf and we had traveled a lot and seen a lot of places. And I'd looked at all the magazines and started reading books about it and things like that. And so ultimately, I learned that most people in the profession got a degree in landscape architecture. And so and I really credit my parents. They were the ones who really pushed me when it was time to go to college. It was going to be easy for me to just major in business or whatever. And they were the ones who were really kind of pushing me, like, hey, you can always do business, but this is all you've ever wanted to do. Why aren't you going after this or whatever? And so went and I grew up in Wisconsin, went to the University of Wisconsin, got a degree in landscape architecture, reached out to pretty much everybody in the business regarding potential internships or job opportunities, and ended up working for Robert Trent Jones too right out of college. And there was a lot of synergy there. They had designed the golf course at the University of Wisconsin, where I played in high school, and I worked there in high school. In college, I had done a year-long independent study project, kind of designing a second golf course. So when it came time to interview and talk about different things, there were lots of different things to talk about. And so ultimately, that's what led me out west to California. And I started my first day of work at Robert Trent Jones too was the day before 9/11. So it was a lot of luck involved. I felt like I did everything you were supposed to do, and then a lot of it boils down to luck and being in the right place in the right time and getting an opportunity. And then obviously once you get an opportunity, trying to take advantage of that and keep going. So I'm what, 22 years in now, and loved every minute of it. Had my own firm now since 2012, and keep pinching myself that this is what I get to do.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, let's talk about some of your most recent work. And I guess some of the questions I have today are, I asked them in reference to Lakeside Golf Club, where we were in Houston a couple of weeks ago. But I guess these could be answered just within the context of your job as general. So, feel free to go whatever direction you want here. And so I guess first thing would be, I'm curious to hear when you are commissioned to do a project to, using Lakeside as our example here. What does that communication look like between you and the club with regard to, okay, so you start meeting with the golf committee and they start to size you up in terms of, okay, what do you see for our golf course? And then I'd imagine that there's kind of some flipping of the script there of, hey, here's what I see for the golf course. And, does that jive with what you all are looking for? So talk to me a little bit about how that back and forth looks and how that all ends up being you being the person that's hired to do a particular project.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's very different for each project. And I think there's kind of different phases to that too, and that some of that happens actually, before you're hired and start working with the club. The interview process is very much one where they're feeling you out and you're feeling them out. So whenever I interact with a club, I'll ask a million questions. I'll just try to learn as much as possible about the club, the site itself, the golf course that's there, the membership, the leadership, the staff. Learn as much as you possibly can about the whole facility, what their history is, what their goals are for the future. If they're talking to multiple designers and going to interview, three, five, or 10 people, I always try to ask, well, who else are you talking to? And you can learn a lot from who else they're talking to, whether or not you may or may not be a good fit. If they list off a bunch of names that have a very, very different approach than you do and a different design style and kind of work very differently than you do, then maybe might not be the right fit. If they're talking to a bunch of people who you share a similar philosophy to and you really respect their work or whatnot, then maybe you think, okay, all right, these guys have done their homework, and let's kind of go from there. And so it's really just trying to learn as much as you can about the club and the people and what their goals are. And every club's different, and what's right for one club might be different than what's the right solution for another one. So I think through that process you try to just learn as much as you can, share as much about yourself and how you go about the process. One thing I've learned over time, particularly with private clubs, and again, they're all different, but it seems like the ones that I've dealt with, there's a lot of membership engagement that's needed. And so kind of investing the time and energy to kind of bring the membership along and share with them what the vision is and why that makes sense for their club and walk them through the different ideas and things like that. And those are settings that I'm comfortable in. I'm happy to stand up in front of a couple hundred people and walk them through what something could look like and others. And some people like that part of the job and other people hate that part of the job. So depending on which club it is, that may play a bigger role than others. But it's really just, like you said, both sides kind of feeling each other out to see what could be the right fit.
What were some early things you identified with Lakeside, be it through the membership, the people that you were communicating with, or the property itself, that made you say, "Hey, this could be a project that would fit well for me"?
Well, when you study the site, the first thing that jumps out is it's in the city and it's a big site. It's about 200 acres. So when you're thinking about horses that are 70 plus years old, that's fairly rare. Oftentimes you're dealing with properties that are 100 to 150 acres. So to have 200 acres for just an 18-hole facility, that's a nice big property. It's a core property. There's no houses or roads that go through it. So when you have that situation, that means that there's the opportunity, if it's appropriate, to move some of the puzzle pieces around, to maybe reroute holes or change things as needed. If there's lots of, houses or road crossings and things like that, oftentimes you're kind of locked into the routing. So the property stood out as being big enough and having enough interest. The club itself had an interesting history in that, it started in 1951. They were planning to do a big project when Hurricane Harvey hit, and Hurricane Harvey compromised their clubhouse, and so they paused the golf project and built a brand new clubhouse. And they had made a very significant investment in the clubhouse. You were out there, you saw it's a huge 80,000 square foot facility. Everything's bigger in Texas, right?
Truly.
And so when you saw their commitment to the club in that way, you got the sense that they were committed to doing things the right way on that front. And then you get a feel for the people and whether it was the staff that was involved, C.W. Canfield, who's director of golf, Terry Hutcherson was the superintendent. Some of the leadership that was involved and the committees, you just got a sense or a feel for the people. And so there were lots of things to get excited about. Quite frankly, I didn't think that I would have a great chance. I was kind of a very late addition to their list of people to talk to. I had never heard of Lakeside Country Club before they called. I'm pretty sure they had never heard of me before somebody gave them my name. So I thought I was a pretty good long shot, but once I had the chance to meet them and get on site, I got excited, and I think they did too.
And so when you get a job and now you're starting to focus in on the site and put together your plan of what this thing's going to look like, how does that process start to go with regard to potentially researching other courses that are similar or sites that are similar? Do you start to do that, kind of gather your data pieces on, what is my vision for this, and then what could I potentially take inspiration from elsewhere?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. There's probably a couple different aspects that are at play. So there's the strict golf design aspect side of things. So, my head's probably spinning well in advance as to, okay, Lakeside's a very flat site, Houston flat in general. We're in the south, so you've got certain grass, you got warm season grasses, you've got certain vegetation types and things like that. So your head's probably already spinning there. Okay, what are great examples of great golf on similar sites in the South? So that's kind of where my mind went on the strict golf design side of things. But then you're trying to understand the club and what are the club's goals. And at Lakeside, you've got a very big membership. There's, I think, over 1,000 members total, and a very wide range of users. So you've got, a number of scratch golfers, as well as a big senior group and women's group. And so the first thing that I do is I literally go out there and I watch people play golf and just try to gain a better understanding of how the course plays day in and day out. Again, spend a lot of time with the superintendent. And the thing that really jumped out when studying the golf course was just that for the average golfer or somebody who wasn't a bomber or a scratch player, the course was really hard. Water was in play on 14 holes. There were a lot of forced carries. There were holes out there, like, the old ninth hole was a medium length par four dog leg right that played second shot played over water. So you would get up there and you'd hit a long iron or a hybrid off the tee, and you'd hit a wedge or a 9-iron into the green, and you wouldn't think anything of it. And yet I went out there and I watched a number of seniors or ladies or shorter hitters get out there, and they'd hit their drive, and it may or may not end up in the fairway. They'd look at the water. They'd say, okay, I can't get over the water on my second shot, so I'm laying up. So they lay up. They didn't lay up very good, so they kind of laid up in the rough. Now they're kind of on a downslope in the rough trying to hit over the water. They're like, okay, I can't do that. So they lay up again. Then they're trying to hit it over the water, and they top it into the water, and they drop, hit one over, and three putt for a nine or whatever, you know. So you're watching two different user groups play the same hole, and it just plays so differently. And you saw that in a few different places. So gaining an understanding of who the membership is, what their goals are, how the course plays for the different user groups, that's a really important part of the puzzle as well.
So playing on top of that, you know, you mentioned flatter sites in the South being something that you were considering, and how that could potentially lead to better playing conditions, you know, maybe level setting things across the membership. And one of the directions that you went with Lakeside was to implement a handful of template holes, similar to a Country Club of Charleston, Yeamans Hall, Mountain Lake, Metairie, some of these really good flat sites in the South. You know, what in particular were you trying to accomplish with the templates? Was it just bringing architectural intrigue into the course, or did you feel that that was something that would give a good chance to kind of level set those playing conditions across a very wide array of members who play in different ways and at different skill levels?
Yeah, I think the first thing was just trying to understand, okay, what's the best golf on similar sites? And so when you look at the different venues that you mentioned, those stand out as some of the best golf on similar sites. And so you say, okay, that approach has worked on similar sites in the past. Okay, so that might be appropriate here. Would I, if Lakeside Country Club was located in Charleston, South Carolina, would I have taken the same approach? Maybe not, because you've got two similar things down the street. But the fact that we were in Houston, Texas, and well, Texas has got some architectural pedigree, there really wasn't much in terms of the golden age designers that are so revered having come through town. So the idea of bringing those template holes or kind of that McRaynor look to the golf seemed like, okay, it's something that doesn't exist in Texas or in the Houston area. It does seem to work well on similar sites, and it seems like it could be a fit for this particular property, and it would function well too. So the idea of kind of a flat bottom bunker, more of a grass face, Houston's prone to big storm events where you can get washouts. So it could actually function better than if you had kind of a high sand flash face to things. And so having kind of fill pads for greens, again, can work well from a function standpoint in terms of the overall drainage. So whether it was the function, whether it was bringing architectural interest to Texas that wasn't there before, something new to the marketplace, and just something that kind of fit, all of those kind of played a role into it.
Yeah. So going back to something that you mentioned earlier of the course playing very difficult for not so good players, and then maybe not so hard for better players, like what is your kind of 101 version? If someone were to ask you the question of like, okay, I get that certain golf courses play easier for good players and then really punish not so good players. Like, how do you describe to someone in the simplest terms what you try to do as an architect to converge the difficulty for bad and good players?
I often will talk about the slope, right? Because the slope really, in layman's terms, is potential for disaster. And the potential for disaster really relates to the quote average golfer. The top amateur, the pro, doesn't really have a disaster. A disaster for them is two bogeys in a row, right? So when you think about the slope, what contributes to a high slope? Well, it's a lot of water in play, it's out of bounds, it's forced carries, it's, you know, deep punishing bunkers on the right side of a hole, things like that. So the things that give, quote, the average golfer a lot of trouble aren't necessarily the same things that give a scratch player trouble. And that's the beauty of it is so I always walk a membership through the idea of an approach shot to a green. And I say, okay, when we study Lakeside pre-renovation, I think 16 out of the 18 greens had trouble left and right, whether it was bunker left and right or bunker right and water left or whatever it was, trouble left and right. So you put the average golfer in that situation and the approach shot is scary. There's no bailout, right? And they're not good enough to execute what they want to do regularly. So they're likely going to end up in that trouble. And then once they're in that trouble, they're not usually good enough to navigate it. So if they hit it in the bunker, they might top one, they might scull one out to the other side and start playing ping pong and whatnot. For the scratch player, if you put trouble left and trouble right, you've really taken all the thought out of it. You've told them you can't go left, you can't go right. They focus right in on the green or the smaller target, and they are good enough to execute. So 9 times out of 10, they're gonna hit it generally where they want. If they do miss and they end up in a bunker, they are good enough to get out of there. It's, you know, they'll get up and down half or more. So that's not what's making golf tough for the scratch golfer. What's making golf tough for the scratch golfer are the internal contours of the green and what happens to the ball after it hits the ground. And so if you take that, if you've got this situation with a bunker left and a bunker right, and you take one of those bunkers away, so there's only a bunker on one side, and then the other side is fairway, and maybe it's fairway with different contours, some contours that feed into the green and some that feed away from the green, things like that. All of a sudden, the approach shot for the average golfer gets a lot easier. It looks more inviting. There's a bailout, so they have a bigger target to aim at. They feel more confident with that shot. If they do miss it, now they can use a putter, a 7 iron, sand, whatever club in the bag is most comfortable for them, they can use. They don't have to navigate that bunker shot. So the golf course has gotten more fun and more playable for that average golfer. The scratch golfer, that's what gives them something to think about. All of a sudden, if that bunker is not there and there's a contour on the edge of the green that feeds the ball into the green, their eye goes from the center of the green to the edge of the green, and they're thinking, okay, do I want to use that contour? If I do use that contour, do I want to draw the ball into it? Do I want to fade the ball off of that contour? Do I want to hit it high and use that contour or chase it in low? All sorts of choices on their approach shot. And when you get them thinking and giving them choices, more often than not, they don't execute as well. And the same applies when they get around the green. If they miss the green in a fairway hollow, now they've got to decide sand wedge, 7 iron, putter. If I use the sand wedge, do I fly it all the way there? Or do I hood it and two hop stop it and let it chase? You know, all those different options come into play. And so they don't execute as well. So that's just kind of one example where you can make a golf course more fun and more interesting for the average golfer, and more thought-provoking and more challenging for the better player at the same time.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing there basically is that for the good player, you just need to get the wheel spinning because that's going to make things a little bit more difficult mentally speaking. And then for the bad player, you need to get the wheels to not spin because when their wheels spin, it's when they see a bunch of bad stuff. And then it's just a complete downward spiral from there.
I think it's that and understanding what shots are tough for people. So, you know, at Lakeside, for example, there were a number of holes where there were two bunkers kind of stacked on top of each other, one that would be greenside and then one that would be, you know, 10 yards short of the green, short of that bunker. And if an average golfer got in that first one, you know, it was next to impossible for them to get it out over the next one or whatever. So that was really a massive penalty for them. So just understanding which, you know, what types of things are difficult for what types of players. And so for a good player, in my opinion, short grass and contour are the things that are the most challenging. And so introducing those and make the golf course interesting for them and challenging for them. Ironically, those things are more palatable for the rest of us.
I'm in the grand scheme of things, probably in that good player camp. And I don't know that I speak for everyone when I say this, but I certainly speak for myself in saying, if I have a ball going offline towards the green, I am rooting for it to find either some sort of rough or a bunker for sure. Short grass is not where I want it to end up, because you know what's going to happen to some degree if it's in a bunker. Let's set aside a plug lie. Let's set aside some terrible lie in the rough. But from short grass, if you get short-sighted somewhere, you get a little bit of a funky lie. To me, that's a lot harder to control than being in a bunker, finding rough. People kind of know how to handle those. But again, I'm speaking somewhat for myself as a guy that doesn't love to chip off short grass. But I agree with you that short grass can be much more of a mental conundrum for good players than a bunker or rough.
Well, just think about how many times you've played a round of golf and you hit your approach shot from 200 yards and you miss the green. You're 200 yards away from your ball and you've already grabbed your sand wedge out of your bag.
Yeah.
Because you know it's in rough, or you know it's in a bunker. You don't know the exact situation, but you know the shot you're going to hit. It's going to be that open-faced explosion shot. And to me, golf is a lot more interesting when there are choices to be made and different shots to hit. And so I think the more opportunity we can give players to think and choose different routes to get there, the more interesting and compelling golf will be. And particularly at a private club where you're going to play the same golf course over and over and over again. I think those things are important.
Yeah, totally. Well, Jay, to close out here, and then I'll toss you over to Mr. Simas. I have kind of a two-part question to ask here. First part being, you know, what specific things about Lakeside are you most excited to see once the course does open up and people start playing it, be it specific holes, specific shots? Just what are you most excited to see and hear about? And then the second part is, how much time do you let surpass before you really start to make a judgment about how things turned out? Because, you know, the first month or 4 months or even a year of a golf course, it hasn't truly grown in and the conditions aren't truly what they will be for the next however many years of the golf course. And so what is that window of time between opening and when you start to actually make a judgment on, hey, how did this thing come out?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'll take the second part first. And, you know, I think giving it a couple of seasons makes a lot of sense. So not only is it growing in, so you're letting the golf course grow in, it's evolving. You want to see it through a full year and through the full change of seasons. And, you know, golf courses play differently in the summer than they do in the winter. So you want to go through that cycle. And you probably want to get it through the grow-in cycle as well. So probably a couple of years is a good time to monitor, to pay attention to things. There might be certain things that pop up in that first window that you could identify. I'm not sure there's a golf course on Earth that's been worked on that they haven't added some form of drainage after it's already been done. So there's usually something like that pops up somewhere. But I think giving it a couple of years to study it and understand what's working, what's not working. And particularly when you've got a lot of those short grass slopes, you spend a lot of time working on those, trying to get those just right, thinking about how the ball is going to react, actually watching how that evolves. Sometimes it can be a little bit different. That was my biggest takeaway. One of my two biggest takeaways up at Chambers Bay was just the difference between how the ball would react on a concave slope versus a convex slope. So you could create two slopes that were very similar in their shaping in terms of the overall grade differential. You could have two-foot slopes, but the concave one, the ball's going to react one way, and the convex one, the ball's going to react drastically differently. And so how does that relate to everything around it? The other big takeaway up there was just traffic patterns on fescue and how quickly things can get beat up. But I think a couple of seasons is a good time to monitor and assess. In terms of what am I most excited to see, I'm just excited to see how the golfers will play the golf course. So it's drastically different than what was there before in terms of the details of the shots and the options that are available. We went to great lengths to try and make the golf course look and feel like Lakeside so that the members who had been playing there for 20 years are still going to feel comfortable and it's still going to feel like their club. We've had a number of them out for tours through the process, and we've heard that that it does feel comfortable to them. So we felt like we were winning on that front. So that's good. But just in terms of, they've been trained over the last 25 years to hit the ball at the flag because there was trouble left and right. And now, on certain holes, the play is going to be to land the ball short right of the green and let the slope feed. And in others, it's going to be to fly it beyond the pin and let the backslope help them. On certain holes, the preferred spot to be off the tee is going to be the very right edge of a 70-yard wide fairway, whereas others, it might be the left third of the fairway or whatnot. So it'll be very different. So I'm really eager to watch. Having been through this process before, it will take people some time, and I'm sure there will be some frustration early. If they come out there and just fire at every flag and aren't thinking about what's going to happen to the ball once it hits the ground, you're going to have a lot of people saying, "Oh, I hit a perfect shot on this hole and I ended up in a bad spot." And that's where you have to kind of walk them through. Well, in order to get to where you want to go, the best way to get there is to actually play over here. And so we'll do some things. We'll take people out there and give them some tours and walk them around and kind of give them some tips on how to play the golf course. But I'll be eager to just see how they attack, particularly some top players. I'd love to watch some top players out there too, because I think they would be well served again to kind of land the ball short and let it release on, which isn't the normal game for a lot of top players. A lot of top players like to fly the ball to the hole, and I think there's some added challenge out there if they take that approach. I'd be curious to see how they would navigate things. So just eager to watch how people choose to play. And then over time, like we talked about with the grow-in, just to see the evolution of the ball roll. We've installed a lot of drainage out there. We've crafted all these slopes, hoping that the golf course will play firm and fast. Dane Alexander, our superintendent, is a maestro and really committed to having the golf course play firm and fast. So he'll do everything in his power to offer up those conditions. But just seeing how well we can pull that off on a site that's not maybe naturally set up for that. Houston isn't the first place you think of when you think of firm and fast. So, seeing what that ball roll will be a lot of fun over time.
Cool. Well, to get a little bit more in the details on the conditioning and the drainage and all of that stuff, we'll cut this part of the conversation. I'll toss you over to my co-host, Mr. Walker Simas. So with that, Jay, thank you for joining me today. Really enjoyed chatting and look forward to being in touch.
Thank you, Henry. Appreciate everything.
And now a quick word about our friends at Good Walk Coffee. Mr. Simas, what's your coffee game been like recently?
Man, I always, and I mean always, have the Mudball Half Calf on me. I've been loving the bump and run cold brews on the go, and lately, it's been the breakfast ball.
Give me a little bit more color on the bump and run cold brew.
Well, I love making coffee at home, but I can't do it all the time. And when I really got to move and I need my Good Walk, I reach straight in the fridge, grab a can, and go, and I get exactly what I need.
Where can the people go if they want to get involved with our friends at Good Walk Coffee?
You can purchase all your coffee, cold brew, espresso, pods, cases, beans, merch, and more for 20% off using code THETIE. That is THETIE at checkout. Set your custom subscription. The world is yours only at goodwalkcoffee.com. I really enjoyed the dirt. I was keenly watching the pizza reviews from Detroit. So just thrilled to hear that sort of content. And you got it.
I'm not the best foodie, but if it's pizza, I can hold my own.
Pizza's the best. It's like everybody's favorite food. There's so much variety, and it's kind of like my opinion of golf. be curious if you share this view, but there really is no such thing as bad pizza. There's pizza that's worse than the good stuff, and everybody likes what they like, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think I agree that, you know, it's even bad pizza is still very, very tolerable. I think I don't know because I'm not a chef, but my guess is if I were a pizza chef and I were eating bad pizza, it might feel differently to me. And so there's a number of golf courses that I kind of cringe at and yeah. think, you know, there's only so many golf courses in the world. There's only so many opportunities to build them. How can we miss on so many of them? You know?
Yeah, this is a great, I mean, that's like perhaps the best lead-in we could have to this discussion ever. I loved kind of the closing to your recording with Henry, which is about playability, about choices. Obviously, choices are super important for a golfer to have when he or she is playing a really interesting golf course. But choices are also really important for an architect. Like if you have no room to breathe in, it's kind of hard to show off your skill. And obviously at Lakeside, you mentioned it being about 200 acres. You had some room to breathe. You had some room to kind of reroute the golf course and reorient some of the offerings of the club. Leading things off today, I'm just curious what your approach was to not only rerouting the golf course, but rerouting some of the offerings, the short course, the range, the where the first tee is located, things that just make the overall experience more worthwhile.
Well, I think it gets back again to every club is unique, every golf course is unique, and so the client, in this case the club, has a unique set of goals. And so having a good understanding of who the membership was, how they use the facility. Lakeside and the Houston market is unique in that the clubs there have, you know, 1,000 or more members for 18 holes, which I can't think of another market in the country that's like that. Usually you have 200 to 400 members for 18 holes. And so the club, well, offering, you know, amazing amenities, a world-class clubhouse and everything that goes with it. I mean, it's really busy. They're doing 45,000 plus rounds a year. And so having an understanding of how the facility is used, how they want to use the facility is really critical. So once you have some of those parameters, then that can guide you as to the space that we need. So how many people are going to be using a driving range at one time? How deep does that range need to be based on the skill levels of the players? Can you find a space on the property that orients north-south? Ideally, you'd like your range to face north just for the sun angles. If that's not available and it has to run east-west, do you have enough room to have tees on both ends so that they can set it up so that you're not looking into the morning sun or the evening sun? And so, as was the case at Lakeside, when I got there, they already had two, quote, driving ranges, both of which were undersized and required nets and poles, and they had balls that were going beyond the boundaries of the different ranges and whatnot. And so when we studied those areas, it became very clear, like, let's have one driving range that's world class, and that fit best a little further south. It was oriented east west, but we had the ability to stretch it out so that we could have tees on both ends. That left the other facility, which is closer to the clubhouse, but it's the entry road bisects it in the golf course, so it has its kind of own feel to it, allowed us to set up a short course. And again, because it's a really, really active club with a big junior program and things like that, that short course was a great amenity that they didn't have before that we could offer up that would ease a little bit of pressure off the golf course. So a lot of it is understanding the site, understanding the client, and then trying to come up with the right program for that club. And then it's about kind of space allocation and getting creative with how you shift the puzzle pieces around.
Totally. And then that first tee and the maintenance building and It's going to be difficult for those listening, and I look forward to providing some video to support this, but talk about, you know, from your perspective, talking with the club, looking more towards getting people out on the golf course. You've got that massive, like, Himalayas putting green out there. Getting to one tee is now more convenient, and it kind of sets you forth onto the front nine, being largely like taking up the same ground, sort of, especially those first few holes. But talk to me about the process of kind of reorienting the first hole. Was that a symptom of kind of, was that a symptom of where the range went? Which one came first?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I don't know that one came first, you know, the because of where the ranges were located, those were kind of separate questions to solve. As it related to the first tee, when I got there, you know, the first tee was basically right next to the entry drive. And the tee shot, it was a dogleg right par four. And at the corner of the dogleg on the left-hand side was the fitness building. So many balls, you know, that the fitness building was kind of your target line. Many balls were actually hitting the fitness building. And so in my opinion, it just didn't set a great tone for the golf in that, you know, here you are, you're ready to start your round and you've got cars driving in right next to you. You're looking at, even though we have 200 acres of kind of beautiful wooded landscape, you know, the first thing you're seeing is the fitness building. And so as we talked with the club about some goals, you know, they lost their clubhouse in Hurricane Harvey. And so they built a new clubhouse, which is really fabulous, right? So it's huge, 80,000 square feet, and, you know, just beautifully done with big patios and verandas overlooking the golf course. And yet the golf course was very much separated from the clubhouse. There were kind of a line of trees where that first tee was located. You really couldn't see it from the clubhouse at all. And so one of our goals in the overall project was to have much better synergy between the course and the clubhouse. They'd made this great investment in the clubhouse. They were going to invest in the golf. Let's make sure that they complement each other. And so there was this big grove of trees between the what's referred to as the Oxbow Lake, which kind of is the backyard of the clubhouse, and the first hole. And that grove was big enough that you could keep a third or half of that grove and still and do some clearing along the lake edge and place some tees there. And those tees would be much closer to the clubhouse. And so as I went through the process and looked at what the possibilities were, we saw that, oh, okay, here's this option to get hole number one tees right along the lake edge. The trees that were there that we would keep would buffer the view of the fitness center. So you wouldn't be looking at the fitness center at all. They would buffer shots from going that way too. So now all of a sudden you've got a first tee that's closely connected to your beautiful clubhouse. It's right along the edge of the lake. So it really is starting to give you that sense of place. Hey, here we are at Lakeside. This is it. And yet it didn't, it was an opportunity for the water to be part of the experience without being a real penalty. So the tees are at the edge of the lake, but the carry is very insignificant. You know, if you're playing the right tee, you know, any shot that gets airborne should get over the water. And so that was, again, kind of a little trick to have the water be part of the experience, but not be punishing the golfer. So we thought that all of those things just gave it a much better, you know, sense of place and a start to your round that is one that you'd want.
So you mentioned the lake, which is kind of a key theme of what was turned over from the old course. You mentioned that there were just so many shots that involved water hazards, not just for great players, but more importantly for players who it was going to affect doubly. And it seemed like a big priority for this renovation was making sure that the players who didn't need to be having massive carries and getting double penalties for these water hazards were compensated. And I'm curious what the process was to get that done. It's one thing to move a bunker, right? Like you fill it in and take care of the drainage. And but water is a very different animal. What kind of thinking goes into that sort of process?
Well, you touched on it. You know, the first thing we did was we studied play on the golf course, and there was water in play on 14 holes, and the water was impacting those that we didn't want it to impact, right? So if you're a 15, 20 handicapper, golf is hard enough. You don't need to be hitting it in the water seven times around. So the water, while it was on 14 holes, it really wasn't impacting a scratch player very much at all, but it was impacting the mid to high handicapper. So one of our goals was to say, okay, the members like the water in terms of it being part of the experience, but they don't want it to beat them up all day long. So we said, okay, how can we orient the holes in such a way that the water can be a feature that they can see, that they can interact with, but they're not going to be losing a lot of golf balls? And so we did that a few different ways. Number one is a perfect example. We set the tees right next to the lake. So you feel, you see the water, you feel the water, but you're not hitting your ball in the water. One other example is hole number three. There was a lake kind of tucked in some woods on the right. And in the old version, the path was on the left side of the hole. And now we move the path over to the right side of the hole and take it right along the water's edge. So if it's the summer and you're taking a golf cart, I'm a walker. I always like to walk. But if you're in the summer and it's 110 and you're taking a cart, now you're driving your golf cart past the lake, even though the lake really isn't in play on the golf hole. In terms of reducing how much water was in play, that also led into our discussions. You know, we mentioned Hurricane Harvey earlier and that the whole course was underwater. And so one of our goals was to make the overall golf course drain much better so that when they do have big rain events, they can get out and play golf faster afterwards. And so if you think about your capacity to take on water, if you have a lake that's already filled with water, you don't have any room to take on water. And so there were a few spots throughout the golf course where we had man-made water features. These were ponds that were added for the golf course. So it's not like they were like the Oxbow that was kind of part of Buffalo Bayou and had been there forever. And so those, we talked with all of the agencies to make sure that they weren't waters of the U.S. And we did all our delineations and all those types of things. And we got the thumbs up that if we wanted to, we could basically drain the lake. We weren't filling them in, but if you think of the lake like a bathtub, we were basically just draining the water out of it. So there was a lake that was on the old hole number 8 and between holes number 2 and 7 on the old golf course. And those basically got drained down and turned into a big kind of ravine or a swale that's now sits between the current 2nd and 17th holes. And so that's a situation where on a day-to-day basis, it's going to feel like a big ravine or a swale. And then when they do have really big storm events, they can kind of fill up with water for, you know, a few hours and then eventually go back down. And they can do that without impacting where the fairways are and where you'd be playing golf. So it was a way to solve our drainage problem, solve the playability problem of you know, golfers hitting into the water. And thirdly, important to me, was to give the golf course a little more topography, right? So we had this 200 acres, and when you've got generally flat land and then you have a lake, the lake is flat too. The water level is flat. Now, by draining that lake, all of a sudden you get more topography. So the golf course, in my opinion, has a lot more character and more feel and a better sense of scale to it.
And Texas is extremely flat. This is something that we talked a lot about when we were on site, and it's like, it's very clear when you go that the humps and bumps really matter to the final product. Like, you get those long shadows in a late afternoon and you start to see some of those undulations poke out. And it makes a really big difference. The next thing that I'm really eager to learn about is the green complexes. Like, we all love playing templates. And if somebody's listening who doesn't, they need to get checked. Something's wrong. In particular, I'm curious about the green sites. I know what it's like to play templates, but I'm curious what is different to build them than maybe other greens that you've built in your career or designed? Like, what were some of the key greens out there that were either challenging or really fun to build? And how are they different from other ones that you've built?
Yeah, so what's fun, you know, last night I got a text from C.W. Canfield, our director of golf, and they just had the Easy Locator group out there to map the greens for hole locations. And so he sent me the PDF file of the, we call them the heat maps of the greens. Yeah. And so I was spending an hour or two last night kind of going through all the heat maps, and that was just tons of fun to see. And obviously the templates kind of stand out right away on what some of those are. So that was fun. But, you know, I think with the templates, I guess, again, it's all site specific. It depends on what your goals are. At Lakeside, we thought that templates would work because they had worked well in other locations in the South on flat properties. And we referenced Charleston, South Carolina, Yeamans Hall and Country Club of Charleston. There's a couple other examples as well. So we thought that that could work, and Texas didn't have anything like that. So we thought that was appropriate. You know, if you were doing this in Long Island or in Charleston, you maybe wouldn't choose the same thing. For me personally, I had never done templates before. So it was an exciting, fun thing to do. And don't know if you'll ever get that opportunity again. So it was something fun to do. But again, we weren't trying to copy any particular hole at any other golf course. We were kind of taking the concept and just applying it to Lakeside. And so, for example, our Biritz, oftentimes, you know, the front portion of it is not actually part of the green. It's part of the approach. Oftentimes, the swale is set up in such a way that you don't put pins in the swale. For us, with the amount of play that we got and we're going to get, and the length of the hole, we chose to have the front portion of the green be pinnable and the swale be pinnable as well. And so, again, fitting that into the landscape, normally there's bunkers on both sides. In our setting, we had a big tree that we wanted to keep on the back left portion of the green, so we didn't put the back left bunker back there. So we kind of modified it to the site. In terms of our road hole green, that actually sits as part of a par five, right? And instead of being a long four, it's a five. And in my opinion, that works really well because that spot on the property, we had like 130 yards of width to the fairway. So you could really get way, way, way over to the right and get a very different angle than if you wanted to get way to the left. So that just meant that the hole locations would dictate your strategy that much more. So to me, the most fun part of the templates was trying to figure out, okay, where do they work? Where would it fit on the property? How would that fit in the overall context of the round of golf? Those types of things. And so I think that was the beauty of McDonald and Rayner, was they built these similar holes over and over again, and yet they worked beautifully because they identified the right spot on the property and were able to craft them in such a way that they felt different than the others. And so I think that's more of the magic than anything else. In terms of building the green itself, you know, with those fill pads and with some of the slopes, building a USGA green that has a steep slope, you know, it's challenging because you have to get it right in the subgrade, you have to get it right in the gravel layer, and you have to get it right in the sand. And then in Houston, when you're trying to grow it in and you can get some weather events with those slopes, if you get a washout, you know, so on our Biritz green, you know, really, we were very fortunate. We had kind of a droughty summer. We didn't really have many washouts, probably less than you would have anticipated. But one of the areas that we did have was on the slope on the Biritz green. And so that was an area that Dane and his team have had to work at to make sure that they can kind of just get repaired, and they've done so. But
really quickly, what is the general bullet point process of building a USGA green? I know there are lots of other ways to build a green, but what's the USGA process in a nutshell?
Well, the kind of three different versions are what we call push-up greens, where you're kind of just taking the best local material on site and sculpting from that if you're blessed to have a naturally sandy site and the sands test out. You basically just work with what you have. There's what gets referred to often as the California style, which is basically you're having a certain layer of sand, could be 6 inches, could be 12 to 15 inches of sand, and you're putting drainage pipe in the ground. And then the USGA style, there's the drainage pipe that we talked about that goes at the bottom. There's what we call the subgrade. So you want to basically design your green, and whatever your contours to the green will be, you want to set that up in the subgrade. So you build that in the dirt, if you will. Then you go in and you dig trenches, and you put your drainage pipe in the trenches underneath that subgrade, gravel around the drainage pipe. So now that's all flush. Then you put a 4-inch layer of gravel on top of that subgrade, and it has to match the subgrade. So whatever the contours you had in the dirt, you have those same contours in the gravel layer. And then you
how do you get those to match?
Well, there's little tricks of the trade that you can use. So you can put little stakes all throughout the whole green. You can kind of grid it out and put stakes, and then you fill with gravel and you match to the stakes. Some people actually put old cups, golf cups. They cut them to 4 inches and then they fill to the cups and pull them out. So there's little tools that you can get that way. But it is very important when you're building a USGA green to make sure that it is a uniform 4 inches, because it's easy wherever you have slopes or whatever that, you know, you can have 2 inches in one spot and 6 inches in another, and then it'll perform differently. So you work to get a uniform 4 inches, and then you do a 12-inch layer of your special sandy mix. And again, you want to get that to match. Now, over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a lot of debate as to should you have a uniform 12 inches or should you do what they call variable depth, where you adjust and you've got more sand in certain spots and less sand in others based on low spots or high spots and how dry it'll be or how wet it'll stay and whatnot. So, but the idea is that you basically have to get the green right three different times. You've got to get it right in the subgrade. You've got to get it right in the gravel layer, and you've got to get it right at the final layer.
It's like playing telephone, kind of.
It is. And you want to make sure that you've got the same people working on the greens and that they're committed to all the fine details. And the more intricate the greens are, the more little nuance there is. And you got to, again, get it right three times. And you know, when your subgrade is a nasty clay like we had at Lakeside, you know, Derek Dirksen was our shaper, who's worked with me in a number of spots, and he's uber talented, and he's worked everywhere around the world. And he said, "Oh man, this is some of the worst material I've ever worked with." You know, he's out there and you're trying to get the details of the green, and literally the clay just clods up. And so you're trying to make a really fine refinement to something and add a 10th of an inch here or take 2/10 of an inch off here. And you're working with it and a chunk, you know, just quads out of there or whatever. So it became very frustrating and challenging. And so I spent this year flying back and forth between San Francisco and Houston every week. And so I would go from Lakeside up to Golden Gate Park, where we had this unbelievable canvas of natural sand dunes that tested out that we didn't have to do anything with. So there you just literally, you're playing in a sandbox. You just go play around. If you like it, you're good to go. You get the irrigation around the outside and you're ready to seed it. If you don't like it, you just play around again and you're done. Whereas at Lakeside, you know, you're banging your head against the wall to get it right in the subgrade. And then you've got to, you know, dig all these drainage trenches, and then you got to bring gravel in, you know, on trucks and, you know, get it across the site and dump it in and get it to 4 inches. And it was just amazing, the difference. So when you hear people like Mike Kaiser talk about the value of sand, mm-hmm. you know, not only is it a great medium to play golf on in firm and fast conditions, but from a pure construction standpoint, it's just light years different as to what the process is like.
That's that. Thank you for that answer. That was great. I'm curious what some of the kind of in process iterations were. Like, of course, the golf course is going to be different at opening day than it was when we put it down on paper. Obviously, the bulk of that is pretty much correct, but you do make changes. You're meant to make changes on site based on how the golf course is responding. What are some of the changes that you made out on the golf course that you're really proud of? There's one green in particular that I'm thinking of, but what were some of the changes that you made where you say, man, we battled hard over that one, and I think we came out with it looking right?
Yeah, so I think that was maybe one of the bigger things that was a surprise for me when I first got into the business. You know, I talked earlier with Henry about this kind of all I've ever wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how much you hear about, you know, things evolving in the field, if you've never been through that process before, you just assume, well, why would something change in the field? If I wanted a green to be a certain shape and I drew it that way on plan, why would you change it? I wanted it to be this shape. Or if I, you know, put a bunker here and drew it a certain way, I wanted it to be that way. That's why I drew it that way. Why would you change it? And then you get out in the field and you go through the process and, you know, there's just so many variables that are out there. So whether it's trees that come down that open up a view in the distance, whether it's how a contour of a fairway, you know, ties into a feature and you can picture how the ball roll, you know, there's only so much you can think about on a plan. And when you're drawing a plan for a golf course, which is hundreds of acres, you know, literally the width of the line on the plan is 5 feet. So what does that really mean out in the field? So the details, the magic happens in the field. And so plans can be a valuable tool to help you with budgeting, to help you with permitting and all those different things. But at the end of the day, the plans are a starting point, not a finishing point, in my opinion. And so to me, the magic that happens in the field is, okay, the plan gives us kind of our routing, where we want to go and how we want to get started. And then once we've gotten into the golf hole, that's where we decide, okay, does the bunker really work there? Or would it be better over here? Is it better as one bunker, two bunkers, those types of decisions? And so for me, I don't actually kind of come up with the idea for the green until we're in the field and get started. And so I usually work by crafting kind of a preliminary sketch that gives some dimensions and some ideas for contours and how the ball would move or how the water would get off, some playability notes. And then before we start, I'll sit there and talk it through with the shaper, and more often than not, they may have some idea to go with it that could make it better. And so we just kind of work through that process. We get started. Again, the sketch is there as kind of a starting point. And then once we get started, we don't really need the sketch anymore. We're trying to just build the best green we can, not what was on a sheet of paper.
Right.
And so that's kind of the evolution. In terms of what evolved at Lakeside that I thought happened in the field that made things better, the 10th hole is a long par four. It's a dogleg right. And originally we had planned to have a pond to the left of the green between the 10th hole and the 14th hole. And that was there largely as kind of needed for water storage capacity and whatnot. And as we got into construction, it seemed like, boy, you know, we don't really want to have a pond over there, even though we were kind of trying to keep it out of play. The hole was long enough that people are going to be hitting long shots. I could see some balls ending up in there. And so anyway, we talked to the civil engineers and said, does this have to be filled with water, or could we make this more of just a big ravine? How would we do that? And so we got the thumbs up that we were able to do it as more of a ravine instead of a pond. And so by doing that, that connected into a bigger ravine that's on hole 11 and hole 8. And all of a sudden we were able to take that feature, bleed it into the second half of the 10th hole. And to me, it looks a lot better. it's going to function better from a drainage standpoint, and from a playability standpoint, the golf hole is going to be a lot more playable. So that was a refinement that we made in the field that I think really benefited us. In terms of the greens, I think probably the one you were thinking of is the 13th green, which is another long par four. And that was a green where when we first got started with construction, I had an idea to build a green. One of the things in construction is the people on the site often will give names to the different greens. So the 10th green was referred to as the piano green. For whatever reason, the shape kind of looked like a grand piano from above. And so the 13th hole, I had an idea for a green where the approach, it was shaped kind of like a Tetris piece. So it was kind of a long rectangle in the front, and then kind of a middle section, and then another long rectangle offset. And so we got started, and Derek went out there, and I drew up a sketch, and Derek started building it, and we looked at it, and it just didn't work, right? And so we could keep banging our head against the wall trying to make this concept work, but it wasn't fitting in the land very well. So anyway, I went back to the drawing board and drew it up again and changed some things and drew up another sketch. And Derek is uber talented and he's super fast. He only knows one speed. That dozer goes full speed forward and full speed back all day. So anyway, he had shaped the Tetris green in a day. And then the next day I had given him a different sketch. So he goes out there, he builds green number two at 13. And I feel terrible, right? So the first one didn't work. Now the second one didn't work either. And I'm like, oh man, do we just live with it? Cause I don't want to upset Derek and he's already done it twice, but it's really not working. So I said, all right, we got to do this one more time. And he's like, I'll do as many as you want. I'm just here building or whatever. So anyway, the third time was the charm. We scrapped the idea of the Tetris screen. It's still a very long, deep green. It's about 150, maybe 160 feet deep. And it's higher in the front than it is in the back. So there's a front hole location, and then it kind of drops down a foot or two and releases away. So it's a pretty interesting green. It's got some interesting contours around the green. I think it works well for the shot. Again, we're asking you to hit a long iron or a fairway wood approach in there, but it's open in front. You can bounce the ball in, and there's helping contours. So it's a unique green. I haven't seen one like it anywhere else. And so sometimes the third time's a charm.
I love that. To cap off today, Jay, I want to talk about the journey of undergoing a project like this. I mean, you're on site a lot of days. You've got key members on your team who are also on site a lot. What is it like? I know quiet probably isn't the right way to describe it. I'm sure there are some really quiet days on site, but metaphorically speaking, a lot of quiet days on site before the noise of opening day. And each day the clock is ticking and you're gearing up for showing off this place to the members of Lakeside Country Club. What is that journey like, and what feelings change as you get closer to opening day?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because I think that, in the golf world, we all see all these new golf courses that open, or courses that get renovated, or courses that host these championships. And there's all sorts of publicity, whether it's magazines or podcasts and drones or TV coverage. And it seems pretty glamorous and exciting. And the reality is that building a golf course is tough, and that there's probably on a really big project, there's hundreds of people that work on it, and smaller projects, there's dozens of people who work on it, and they show up early and they stay late. And in the case of Houston, it was over 100 degrees for 2.5 months straight or whatever. And so it's really hard work. And I'm not the one doing the hardest work in terms of, digging trenches and stuff like that out in the field. It is a family. It is a team. With these private club renovations, you've got a situation where the members have been playing their golf course. They don't want any downtime. So a day of downtime is too much. So all of these projects have gotten condensed where you have to go faster and faster and faster. And so there's a schedule and there's a budget. And so, you know, being a part of that team, you feel a great sense of responsibility to hit the schedule and hit the budget. So there's that kind of stress. You know, a former colleague of mine, whenever we get too stressed out, he'd say, at the end of the day, it's just grass, right? Remember that, it's just grass. You know, this isn't life or death. And, you know, there are some things that put things in perspective. So you're out there, you're working your butt off, you're freaked out about the schedule, you're worried about the budget, you're trying your best. You know, you get an irrigation break or, you know, things aren't working, you get frustrated and you feel like it's the end of the world. And at the end of the day, it's not that big of a deal. On our project at Lakeside, our longtime superintendent, Terry Hutcherson, who'd been with the club for 20 plus years, and nobody wanted this project more than Terry. And he was actively involved for my 4+ years of planning before we got started. And we got into the middle of construction and he's out there building a bunker with us on one day. And I see him at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I get a call, later that night and was informed that he had passed away. And so, you know, Terry was the heart and soul of Lakeside, and whether it was our entire team, the entire maintenance team, the construction team, all involved, the whole membership, you know, that was a real hard hurdle to get over. And so that was a tough one in the spring that, you know, really set us back weeks. And you know, there isn't a day that goes by that everybody on that project isn't out there thinking about Terry and what he would think of each thing and how excited he was for everything. So those are the things, you know, I'm sure if you asked football players or things like that about the big game or whatever, they probably talk about, well, my memories are more about the locker room and the interaction. So the rewarding part of the journey is the journey itself and those long days and the hurdles that you have to overcome. People always ask, what's your favorite hole at this course or that course? And, you know, it sounds like a stupid cliche, but the answer is usually all of them, but for different reasons. You know, some of them you love because they were really hard and you didn't think they were going to work. And then you found the right solution and it worked. Others you love because they're just beautiful and they were there and you pulled it off and other people like them, things like that. So when I went, when I first went through the process, I always assumed that opening day was the best day of the whole thing, that was the big game. That was the heart pounding moment. You'd run out of the tunnel and feel, you know, all the feels. And when I got to go through that for the first time, it couldn't have been any different. It was very surreal. I knew where the next tee was. There was nothing on that property that was going to be new to me, right? It was exciting for everybody else showing up for the first time. I've described it kind of like being a surrogate parent. You go through this whole process and then you hand it off to somebody else and then they get to enjoy it for the rest of your life. So it's important as somebody, a designer or somebody in the construction field, it's important to enjoy the journey because at the end of the day, the journey is probably the most rewarding part.
What a great way to cap off. Jay, thank you for being here with us today. Look forward to more down the line. Wishing you all the success in the world and thanks for showing us what you do every day. That was pretty cool.